Cavalcade of Kings. James the Second. The cavalcade of kings rides on, and Charles the Second, the Merry Monarch, joins his spirit companions and rides with them, leaving his brother James the Second to succeed him on the throne. James was the second surviving son of Charles the First, and was born on the 15th of October, 1633. A short time before his father's execution, he escaped to Holland. Then he went to France. After the restoration of the Stuarts, James returned to England, was recognized as the Duke of York, and made Lord High Admiral of England. In November 1659, he married Anne Hyde, daughter of the Earl of Clarendon. After her death, in 1671, he made a public avowal of his conversion to the Catholic faith. In 1673, the English Parliament passed the Test Act, requiring all civil and military officers to receive the sacrament according to the rites of the Church of England. James refused and was obliged to resign the office of Lord High Admiral. Later, he married Mary, daughter of the Duke of Modena. After the Popish plot, James had to retire to the continent, and during his absence, an unsuccessful attempt was made to exclude him from the throne. At the death of Charles II in 1685, James became King of England. At the moment, we find him in conversation with Sancroft, Archbishop of Canterbury, who is remonstrating with the King.
I say you're being false to the promises you made to the people and to Parliament, my son, by forming this secret council with Father Peter.
Take heed, meddlesome priest. I will brook no interference from you or Parliament or the people in the matter of my religion. Remember, I am the king and my word is law.
You have been made king by the loyalty of the people, my son.
And as long as they allow me to worship God in my own fashion, I will uphold all the rights of the English church and the people. This I swore to do on my accession to the throne.
Full well I know it, my son, but you have broken your solemn vows. Immediately after your accession, you proceeded to levy, on your own warrant, the customs and excise duties which had been granted to your brother Charles only for his lifetime. Furthermore, it would seem that the one object of your reign is not to uphold the English church, but to re-establish the Catholic religion in England, and this you are doggedly pursuing with stupid obstinacy.
You pompous old fool! Dost dare to cross your crozier with the sword of your king? Odd rot, you have a mind to throw you into the tower for your temerity.
Your threats do not cause me a moment's fear, my son.
Perhaps not, but the sizzling of a pair of red-hot pincers as they meet upon thy wagging tongue might cause you to reflect upon the wisdom of a closed mouth.
You would need many pincers, my son, for there are many such tongues as mine. The laws of England are set down by Parliament, and no man, even though he be King James, can set them aside of himself.
Then it is high time the king made the laws.
Many far greater and stronger kings than you, my son, have pitted themselves against the bulwarks of the people and smashed their kingly skulls in the attempt.
I have many loyal supporters. The Tories are with me to a man.
And the Whigs have risen to a man under the Duke of Monmouth and have gathered a mighty army together to fight for their rights. They landed at Lyme in Dorsetshire but a day past.
You lie, else I would have heard tidings of such a revolt. Ha ha, Monmouth indeed. Monmouth, the base-born son of my brother. The carrion would not dare pit himself against King James of England.
Continue as the ostrich, my son. Bury thy obstinate fool's head deep in the sand. Continue to blind thyself to facts and live on in thy self-created world of idle fancy. But be prepared to pay the bitter penalty of having your gorgeous plumage plucked from your stupid carcass by stronger and wiser birds.
Sire, I crave speech with thee.
By the saints, am I to know no peace?
There is no peace in England this day, sire.
What meanest thou?
My Lord Duke of Monmouth has landed at Lyme in Dorsetshire with an army, and has raised a revolt in the southwest of England. It is said the people are flocking to his banner. He is marching to Bristol.
Oh, cursed swine of a base-born traitor. Marshal my troops. Marshal my troops, you hear me?
Your Majesty forgets that I am but his courier, not his general.
Do my bidding, you dog. Don't bandy words with your king. Marshal my troops, now at once, do you hear? God rot you.
Yes, your Majesty.
Sancroft, this is some of your doing. But you'll pay for this day's work by the saints you'll pay for it.
Thou art weak, my son, and like all weaklings, you seek to lay the blame of your own iniquities on the shoulders of another.
I am not to blame for this cursed revolution.
You and no other is responsible. You sent a mission to Rome. You hear mass ostentatiously in public with regal splendor. You have become, like your brother, the pensioned slave of the King of France, making the interests of your kingdom subservient to the ambitious designs of that monarch. You have struck blow after blow at the liberties of your people, and at last they have risen against you.
They were dice at war and revolutions. They are but toy soldiers. Nothing will come of it.
My son, a river of blood may yet flow throughout the land. Have a care lest you are not drowned in it.
Monmouth and his followers encountered the royal soldiers at Sedge Moor near Bridgewater. And in the last pitched battle to be fought on English soil, Monmouth was defeated, captured, and beheaded. After the revolution, a terrible vengeance was wrought upon his followers. Jeffreys, the cruelest and most infamous of the judges, presided over what will always be known as the Bloody Assize. It began at Winchester, where a poor old lady, Mrs. Alicia Lyle, was charged with having given shelter in her home to two fugitives from Sedge Moor. Three times the jury failed to find her guilty, and at the moment, we find Jeffreys bullying them into giving a false verdict.
Not guilty? Not guilty? You dare to look me in the eyes and declare this Jezebel, this wanton traitress, not guilty? This woman is proven to have sheltered the king's enemies. She is the wife of one of the judges who signed the death warrant of our king's father, Charles I. She's black with sin, yet you will not declare her guilty. Could seem, gentlemen, that she dare not do so, lest she in turn denounce ye all as traitors to the king. So I shall save you the trouble and denounce ye myself. And as such ye shall suffer the same fate as all who have plotted against the peace and safety of our sovereign. Guards, arrest the jury and arraign them by the side of this woman so that they may share her punishment as they have beyond doubt shared her infamous treacheries.
We declare the prisoner guilty, my lord.
Oh, you declare her guilty, eh? So I've wrung a just and proper verdict from you at last, gentlemen. I knew that when you gave the matter due and careful consideration, the scales would drop from your eyes, revealing the path of duty shining clearly before you. We must all do our duty, gentlemen, no matter how much it costs us. And if I had been one of you and this woman had been my own mother, I would have found her guilty. I sentence this traitress to be burned alive this afternoon. Take her away. Next case.
Matthew Coates. Before the court, my lord, charged with seditious utterances.
My lord!
How do you plead, Matthew Coates?
Not guilty, my lord. I swear before God I'm not guilty. Don't kill me, my lord. Don't, in mercy's name, kill me. I'm an innocent man. I swear it.
The innocent do not shiver with dread. Guilt is writ clear upon thy traitor's face. Guards, have him taken outside the court and hanged. Then cut him down and steep his carcass in the cauldron of boiling pitch. Then hang him on a pole by the roadside as a warning to others who dare pit themselves against the king.
Jeffreys executed in all 300 victims, besides whipping, imprisoning, transporting, and selling as slaves a great many others. For this, he was rewarded by James and made Lord Chancellor of England. This act, together with the suspension of the Test Act by the King and his persecution of the seven bishops, roused the indignation of the people to fever heat, and his expulsion from the throne became necessary. James fled from England, and the throne was declared vacant. It was then decided to invite William, Prince of Orange, and husband of Mary, daughter of James II, to rule England. At the moment, we find William and Mary in Holland, discussing the matter with seven of England's most influential politicians.
Gentlemen, although I have a nearer title to the English throne than Prince William, my husband, I cannot accept the high honor you would confer upon me unless my husband and I rule as joint sovereigns. At the moment, the land of my birth needs a strong man's hand to guide her out of the chaos and confusion for which, alas, my father, James II, is alone responsible. The hand of Prince William is both strong and just, even as his heart is loving and merciful. These are not the words of an adoring wife who sees all the virtues and none of the faults in her beloved husband. They are the words of an English woman whose heart bleeds for her suffering countrymen and who would give her life to restore peace and prosperity to the kingdom which her father, in his intolerable obstinacy, has done so much to ruin.
There is wisdom in your words, madam, and I, for one, am ready to agree to your conditions. Knowing as I do the bravery and trustworthiness of your good husband, Prince William of Orange. What say, gentlemen? Then 'tis agreed, gentlemen, that Prince William of Orange and Princess Mary, his wife, shall be elected King and Queen of England by Act of Parliament.
Oh, we thank you, gentlemen. My beloved wife and I will devote our lives to England and her people, and try with the guidance of the Almighty God to justify your faith and trust in us.